The story of George Elric, Mrs. Elric's wee boy George.
Morning, housewives. My goodness, it's a long time since I said that to all my ladies of the household. But thanks to the BBC Radio 2, here I am once again with another edition of Housewives' Choice. And it's you I'm visiting first, Mary Johnson, in Chilwell, Notts. Here you are then, ladies, fond memories with Henry Hall and a nice cup of tea for all of you.
Mrs. Elric's wee boy George became a household name, firstly through his years as a drummer and singer with the BBC Dance Orchestra under Henry Hall, and then as a presenter of Housewives' Choice. But those were only two of the many careers in his life. He led his own band, he became the manager of the light orchestra leader Mantovani, and he produced records for Lena Martell alongside his frequent TV appearances. The George Elric story starts in Aberdeen in 1903. The eldest child of a family who joked it was five to a kilt. There was no spare cash to go around, and so the smiling voice of radio's first wireless had to be the little-known Elric make. His younger brother, Albert, remembers this particular model.
Years ago, I was just a boy, and he got a cat whisker and made a little radio. And he had it in a tub, so it could be loud. It was the first time I'd ever heard anything coming through the air, and George made it.
At this stage, George was pursuing his ambition to become a doctor, and he had secured a bursary to Robert Gordon's college. His interest in music, however, was gathering momentum with the formation of the Lucinians.
Another boy who was a pianist called Jimmy Ross. He and I got together and he says, "You play drums in the Boys' Brigade. Why don't you get a set of drums and let's start a band?" So that's what I did. I got a set of drums on the Never Never, and the two of us played together, and we played at a lot of the Union Hops. But then we built up the band from there. It became five-piece, then it became eight-piece, then it became ten-piece, and then, of course, became quite a big band, which fortunately won all the competition for the best band in Scotland.
The Lucinians were soon renamed the Loose Onions by the band's student pals, so it was time to change it to the Rialto Band. This drumming lark was getting serious now, so George went for lessons. He practiced a lot at home, much to the dismay of the whole Elric family, especially Albert.
My mother thought that there was woodworm on her dresser, but this was George practicing with his drumsticks, and he was making little holes on the top of the dresser, you know. And I can remember, I thought, you know, he was so rich. He had a do on, and this was, 70 years ago, and I carried his side drum, he carried the big drum, and we went to Ledingham's rooms in Bridge Street in Aberdeen. And he gave me sixpence, and I thought, gee, where's my brother's rich, you know?
George had now reached professional status with the Embassy Band, but he was dreaming of playing with the big bands that had been such a huge influence on him. He decided to leave the northern lights of old Aberdeen and head to the bright lights of London, in search of fame and fortune, armed with only a suitcase, his savings of £100, and a 14-piece drum kit. It turned out the London streets were not paved with gold immediately, and work for an unknown percussionist was very hard to find.
I used to go to Archer Street behind the Windmill Theatre, because all the musicians went there looking for work, and went there several times, and I was nearly out of money by the time I got a first gig, which was a Jewish wedding, down at a place called Monica Downs in the East End. And I was glad to go to that because I came away with a doggy bag.
Soon, George Elric, who was now starting to be paid with money, as well as food, was picking up work more regularly. He demanded an audition at the Glasgow Empire with the Ambrose Orchestra and was hired because of his added skill as a percussionist and his sheer tenacity. Up until now, he had only ever performed live. But in January 1935, he made his recording debut with pianist Billy Mason and his orchestra.
I was playing with him at the Florida Club, and he got invited to do a recording with a fantastic coloured girl called Valeda. And that was my first recording. She was a trumpet player and a singer, and it was became a big hit called Ants in My Pants. And she, the opening of the record, she says, "Georgie boy, just you give me four licks on that drum and I'm away." And that's how it opens with me playing the drums.
Just go down to the drummer's club. You take the streetcar and I'll take the sun. Let's have a party and let's spread good cheer. Oh, you bring the pretzels and I'll bring the beer. Oh, Zez, oh, Z, my, here's the reason why. Oh, I can't dance, I got ants in my pants. I can't dance, I got ants in my pants.
One night, at Chez Henri, George was relaxing with some friends when he spied a beautiful woman and asked her to dance. Within 6 months, the young model became Mrs. Alice Elric. The financial pressure was now on with a wife to take care of, but things eased when he was invited to an audition at the BBC.
Hello, everyone. This is Henry Hall speaking to you. 5:15 is known to millions of listeners as the time of the daily broadcast of the BBC Dance Orchestra.
After some persuasion, George agreed to move from the drum stool to the vocal mic, which he did with great success. The late Henry Hall always remembered the fun atmosphere in the band under his baton, and the first nude vocalist at the BBC.
I had to provide music for the masses of people. I'm really quite a happy person, and I wanted a happy personal thing. And I don't think in terms of presenting programs proudly. I'm very pleased to play for a family. It's talking to Georgie Elric, you know, Scots boy who came from Aberdeen, and I remember he sang a song called The Music Goes Round and Round and comes out here. And he's a wee lad, you know. And when he was singing, we gradually lowered his trousers for him and had a lot of fun, you see. We're a happy band, which came out in our programs.
When you're smiling, when you're smiling, the whole world smiles with you. When you're laughing, when you're laughing, the sun comes shining through. But when you're crying, you bring on the rain. Stop your crying, be happy again. When you're smiling, when you're smiling, the whole world smiles with you.
Quite true, you know. A smile helps every time, especially these days. It's a funny thing, but it costs nothing, and yet it's rest to the weary, daylight to the discouraged, sunshine to the sad. Yet it cannot be bought, begged, borrowed, or stolen, for it's something that is no good to anyone unless it's given away. So when you see someone who is too tired to give you a smile, just leave one of yours. For nobody needs a smile as much as those who have none left to give. Just try it sometime. You'll see. When you're smiling, when you're smiling, the whole world smiles with you. When you're laughing, when you're laughing, the sun comes shining. But when you're crying, you bring on the rain. Stop your crying, be happy again. When you're smiling, when you're smiling, the whole world smiles with you.
Now, the vocal talent of George Elric was present in every home in Britain. And for a young Scottish journalist called John Juner, it was a very welcome sound.
As long as I can remember, George Elric's been part of my life ever since boyhood. When I used to switch on Henry Hall, 5:15 at night, and listen to George Elric. And he was a touch of Scotland. And so when I came to England and still listened on the radio and came across George Elric with his own band, George Elric as a drummer, George Elric singing, it was part of Scotland for me.
A catalogue of top songs was soon gathering around him, and one that became an international hit was The Music Goes Round and Round.
Henry brought it to me. He says, here's a song for you, George. This is something you can do. You know, he liked it, you see. He picked a lot of lovely songs for me. He picked all the songs. I never had any say in what I sang. I never refused. Whatever he gave me, I sang.
This song went down a storm with George, the public and royalty. Fellow water rat, Bert Weedon.
He made a little bit of broadcasting history. On one particular broadcast, he'd done a number called The Music Goes Round and Around. And as you know, as an established broadcaster, when you've done a number, you never repeat it. But he'd sung this number, and there was a phone call from the Queen, who, at that time the Queen, who is now the Queen Mother, of course, and the Queen phoned up and said she liked the number so much, could they please repeat it? So quickly, they organised it that they would repeat the number 10 minutes or so later, and they played the same number twice with George singing, The Music Goes Round and Around. Don't think it's ever been done before or since.
One night while playing in the band, a girl came up, she said, "You're grand." So I replied in words low down, "This is how the music goes round." I blow through here, the music goes round and around, whoa, and it comes up here. I push the first vowel down, the music goes down and around, whoa, and it comes up here. I push the middle vowel down, the music goes down around, below, 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 diddly ho, 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 listen to the notes come out. I push the other valve down, the music goes round and around, oh, 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 and it comes out here. And around, oh, 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 and it comes up here. I push the slide way out, the music goes round and about, oh, 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 and it comes up here. I push the slide way down, the music goes down around, below, 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 dilly ho, 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 listen to the jazz come out. I make the funniest sound, the music goes round and around, oh, 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 and it comes out here.
Having experienced the lean times before, George Elric, now with his son Ian in tow, was determined for unemployment never to return, which meant accepting all offers of work. In 1936, the American arranger and instrumentalist Benny Carter came to London and recruited some of the top British musicians to record an album at Maida Vale. George Elric was signed up on drums, but as he was contracted to the BBC at the time, did the session under a pseudonym. But the BBC found out and soon put a stop to George's moonlighting.
My name on his recordings was G. Kilser, which is an anagram of Elric, you see. And some clever guy wrote an article in the Melody Maker which said, a drummer of BBC fame and George Elric are one and the same. But it's his drumming that matters in Benny's Hot Platters, not his anagrammatical name.
Thank you.
decided to leave the BBC in 1937 to tour theatres with his own band. George, now very much in demand, turned down the offer to join him. Under the management of Jack Hilton, he set about making the name George Elric a solo box office attraction. Tony Harrison of the dance band musicians organisation, the Coda Club, went to see the show.
Around about 1937... he went out into a Jack Hilton show called Youth Must Have Its Swing with Brian Mickey of the BBC. And in actual fact, they took over the old Lou Stone band. It was a typical band show, excellent musicians, needless to say, in the band. But of course, the whole thing was dominated by George's very larger-than-life personality. He sang all the numbers and he introduced quite a lot of youthful artists into the show. But he was a rather dominating personality on the stage. In fact, I suppose it can largely be said about George, he has a very, very large personality.
The show was a major success, selling out theatres the length and breadth of Britain for 40 weeks. Although the star of the show, George was preparing even then for his next career as a manager and impresario.
I was working all the time, but I was also taking note of everything that was happening. And I learned everything about stagecraft from Jack Hilton. He was a fantastic friend.
Having signed a recording contract with Columbia Records and adopting the signature tune, When You're Smiling, through his radio broadcasts, he declined his manager's offer to take over the Jack Hilton band. Instead, he put together his own band and formed a double act with the 14-year-old vocalist Shirley Lenner. This proved to be a lean period. But as wartime approached, George Elric and the Swingaroos hit the dance halls of England and Scotland. During a run at the Greens Playhouse in Glasgow, he recruited tenor sax player Bert Tobias, who was left in no doubt who was the leader.
He worked us hard, yes. We worked hard anyway because we had to travel. Our travelling was mainly on Sunday. From every show we joined, it was really work and travel, you know. But we did have good times because we worked with big shows and stars of the period. People like Adelaide Hall, and who was a great singer. We used to watch her at the side of the stage crying her eyes out at the end of a number. It was wonderful, you know. We made a film, a short film for the end of Patti Gazette. It used to be during the war, they used to put these at the end of a programme of interesting things. And George Elric's band was featured. One of the numbers that's, I think the only number we sang on it was All Those in Favour of Swing Say Aye. That was an interesting thing. It was made in London. Joy was singing on that one, Joy Conway. And George Elric, of course.
Ladies and gentlemen, as president of the Elric Swingaroo,
everybody come and get a button.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm here to hear about your swinging view.
Everybody gotta have a button.
Do you like your music sweet? Do you like it with a ride? Miss Conway, please take a vote and decide.
All those
in favor
of swing say aye.
Aye.
All the ayes have been. All those in favor of swing say aye.
Aye.
Oh, count it again.
meeting's all about. I'll ask you a question when you answer shout. Let's have Burke and then Senator try. All those favors say aye. Way to play. We'll give you a button right away. And now we better give Billy a try. All those babies say aye.
Now here's a little fellow, Johnny Hudson by name. He will surely swing his way to fame. Get on the trumpet, give it a blow. Come on, Johnny, let's go.
And we had this little trumpet player called Johnny Hudson. He was featured with short trousers playing the trumpet. It was a great attraction to people.
Well, all right, Johnny. Here's a button for you. And now let's see what all the boys can do. All those in favor of swing, say aye.
The singer Joy Conway and trombone player Rick Kennedy met, fell in love, and married a year later. Although their time in the Elric Band during the war was comparatively short, they both remember it as a great learning experience, thanks to both Mr. and Mrs. George Elric.
They were marvellous, both Alice and him. It was very, very nice. And Alice advised me on dress. And we went, in those days, we had to have coupons, you know, for the, this was during the war. And then we went into the Piccadixy with Adelaide Hall. That was a show we went into. And, I learned a lot from her, you know, as walking on stage and, you know, giving a number, as she did.
It was good for teaching the stagecraft, you know. He used to say to us, look, you're only on there for 35 minutes, so come on nicely dressed, and if the drummer plays a solo, anybody, whoever's playing a solo, turn and look at him, you know, make the audience see that you're interested in him as a solo. So taught us that, you know, the discipline of a big band.
When war broke out, George failed his Royal Air Force medical because of a troublesome duodenal ulcer, and was enlisted as a grade 4 recruit. His ENSA band toured the UK and visited France entertaining the troops. As the war developed, it wasn't just those fighting at the front that were in danger. Enemy bombers became a real threat to life at home. George escaped disaster thanks to fellow Scot Jack Buchanan.
We were playing the Coventry Hippodrome, and I arrived there on the Sunday, and there was nothing to do, so I went to a cinema where there was a Jack Buchanan film on. But it wasn't a very good film, and I'm afraid I couldn't stand it, and so I left early. But I hadn't been back in my hotel an hour when the siren went, and there was no cinema the following morning. It just hit a direct hit. If I'd waited to see Jack, I'm afraid I wouldn't be here today. I told him a story. I met him in Southampton. He says, you are quite right. He says, I didn't think it was any good either.
George Elric has never been opposed to giving people a chance and always went with his gut feeling. In Glasgow, he played the Barrel Ann Ballroom with his dance band, the Music Makers, when no one else would. He liked the manager, Sammy McIver, agreed a fee, and sold the place out. Then the hall started attracting the big names because the George Elric had played there. The same pattern followed after George agreed to play at Butlin's. This resulted in a lifelong friendship with fellow water rat Sir Billy Butlin. The Coda Club's Tony Harrison.
Billy was very dependent upon George Elric for advice, and who to put into his holiday camps, what types of bands. In fact, he was really the intro into Butlin's holiday camps, if one was an artist or a band. Butlin's holiday camp was very largely George Orrick, if the public knew it.
On the 9th of June, 1862, on a summer's afternoon, we took the bus for Bamburgh, and she was heavily laden. Away we went along Collingwood Street, that's on the road to Bladen.
Holy man, you should have seen us gallant, up the road, along the road.
It was in 1946 that George started presenting Housewives' Choice on the radio. He became a regular presenter until 1967, receiving thousands of letters requesting the most popular songs of the day from the likes of the Beverly Sisters.
He was probably one of the people responsible for making our hit Sisters into a hit. Because, of course, the BBC played it, and that would
be... Well, we didn't promote it. We were promoting the other side, a thing called the Mama Doll song. And the BBC kept playing Sisters, including George.
Sisters, sisters, there were never such devoted sisters. Never had to have a chaperone, no, sir. To keep my eye on her, caring, sharing, every little thing that we are wearing. When a certain gentleman arrived from Rome, she wore the dress and I stayed home. All kinds of weather we came together, the same in the rain and sun. Three different faces, but in tight places, we think and we act as one. Those who've seen us say that not a thing could come between us. Many men have tried to split us up, but no one can. Nobody can. Lord help the mister between me and my sister, and Lord help the sister who comes between me, 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 me and my man.
George's radio days took him to America in 1949, where he managed to secure interviews with some of the biggest stars of the time.
When I was doing Housewife Choice, I went on spec. I did a few recordings, and Perry Como was one, Nat King Cole, Doris Day, Tony Martin. I interviewed him in his suite at the Waldorf Astoria, and halfway through it, his wife, Sid Charisse, walked in from the bedroom because she saw, wanted to know what was happening, and of course she's in the recording as well.
I don't think she needs introduction. She was accepted so beautifully in London, and she has two or three more pictures coming over there. I mean, I'm looking forward to the day when she'll take me to London. And Miss Sid Charisse to everyone who may be listening in.
Well, hello, Sid.
Hello, George. I think Tony and I are both looking forward to seeing you in London next summer.
Well, I'll be looking forward to seeing you both when you're over there. And I'm going to play some more of Tony's records right now. And believe me, I've had a wonderful time over here, thanks to most of you people. You've all been so kind to me, and I'm sure that we'll be able to reciprocate when we come over the other side.
Wonderful.
He was an established radio star now, but television was gaining popularity, and George, never one to miss out on new developments, was keen to embrace this medium.
did Come Dancing in 1951. I was the first one to do the Come Dancing program. They came to me and asked me, would I do it? And I was the anchor man, and I had Sylvia Peters with me. She came along and explained the dresses. Sylvia Peters was the... She was at Alexandria Palace. She was one of the first newsreaders.
The main thing was that we thought Come Dancing was very funny, the two of us. Mainly because the men in those days used to wear huge placards on their backs with the numbers on them. They still managed to dance very elegantly, but this was so they could be identified. And the women were all in these amazing dresses of yards and yards of tulle, all covered in sequins, which I had to describe because it was all in black and white in those days, so I had to talk about the colour and how they had put the sequins on themselves, which they did, most of them. And, of course, the funny thing was they were only stuck on, so by the time they'd finished dancing, everybody was awash with sequins. They were all over the floor. And George used to make me laugh so much, I don't really know why. I used to have to ask him to go behind a piece of scenery when I was doing my bit, otherwise I'd break up.
Whilst pursuing a broadcasting career, George was very aware of the showbiz idiom of it takes 5 years to get to the top, five to stay there, and five to come down. He had suffered personal tragedy when his son Ian was killed by a car, and he was well used to the knocks of the showbiz world. He figured that he had already had a generous helping of success as a solo entertainer in the theatres, and that now a move to the agency business would make sense. The impressionist Afrique, now seeing leaner times, and singer Evelyn Lay signed up to his agency. George had mixed fortunes with them, but he was gearing up for his biggest management challenge yet. Tony Harrison explains.
He has an eye for talent. He can detect great talent when he sees it. The artists that he managed, Mantovani, had been in the business some 20, 25 years before George Elwitt managed him. And one could describe him as a very ordinary West End band leader, probably playing at number two positions in the West End, not the lead band in the restaurants. George Elwick made him into an international personality. It was George Elwick who did it, nobody else.
This view was echoed by the Beverly Sisters.
Although they had that beautiful music, really what was happening in the industry was hyping and promoting was becoming more important. It's no good being beautiful and lovely if you're not properly represented and put into the right situation. And that's what George did for Montague.
And George arranged these massive concerts all over America, coast to coast, a massive undertaking, which he did with ease.
The appearance that George organized everything with ease was due to a lot of preparation and great management skills. As a 50-50 partner with Mantovani, a deal done on a handshake, George took care of all the business. Although not the greatest conductor, Mantovani was undeniably one of the greatest showmen. But when it came to taking a 45-piece orchestra around the world, George had to be Mr. Fix-It. Orchestra member Ivor Marantz.
When we arrived in Canada, we weren't as spoiled as we were when we were in Japan. Instead of having a baggage man, or many baggage men, who lifted everything up and put it in its place, there was no one there. It was just the coach to greet us. And there was immediately trouble, not the least caused by myself, because I wasn't going to lift my guitar and heavy instruments. I wasn't there to be a porter. And I really stood out for this. I insisted that somebody pick the instruments up. But George Elric was able to smooth everything over. He wanted a happy orchestra.
Thank you. Mantovani was to lead the most successful light orchestra in the world under Georgie's watchful guidance. Despite pressure for the orchestra to back big-name vocalists like Nat King Cole, George stuck to his guns and insisted the orchestra was a feature band. This paid off to such an extent that Max Bygraves was left stunned after a chance meeting with him.
I recall the very first gold record I ever received. I was walking to my office in Haymarket and bumped into George. He was coming towards me, and he asked me what I had under my arm. I told him it was a gold record I'd been awarded for my sing-along album. He congratulated me, then said, "I hope one day you'll have as many as Mantovani. He has 60. Now, the rest of the day, I kept thinking what 60 gold records entailed. It meant the Mantovani had earned millions of pounds and the George must have earned a fortune.
Mantovani experienced star treatment from the day he set foot on American soil, which was a first for a British orchestra.
The moment I finished that first tour, I was booked for the next year and so on. Every year, the same story. I did it for 15 years. And in some of the concerts, I did about 64 concerts in 10 weeks. And they put me in hospital with my dear, you know, Dean ulcers again. Yeah, I was taken out with the burst ulcers, it was. Through the strain of having to travel every night, looking for food in different places, and wondering what sort of audience I've got.
That burst ulcer in Chicago put Mantovani in hospital midway through an American tour. Apart from taking care of his friend, George was left with the headache of dealing with 50 people on the road and the uncertainty of fulfilling the rest of the tour. He started by cancelling all the immediate concerts.
One fella in Minneapolis, he phoned and he said, "We're sold out. What am I going to do? What am I going to do?" I says, "Give them the money back." I said, "You can't do anything else." He says, "Well, can you be here next year?" And I said, "I don't know if he'll be here next year." I said, "I can't do anything about it." And he said, "I says, I don't know." So 2 days later, he phoned me and he said, "You'll be amazed, George. Nobody wants their money back. I've told them he'll be here next year." I said, "Well, all I can do is to put you onto the list and give you a date next year. That's all I can do." And he did the date the following year and walked onto a standing ovation.
George and Mantovani went to the top with a successful business relationship lasting 21 years. But it was a Scottish lass, of whom he became manager and record producer, that he guided to the top of the pop charts with her single, One Day at a Time. That was Lena Martell, but she wasn't convinced about the song's potential.
She said, "I don't fancy singing about Jesus." And I said, "But look, it's a good song." And you know, but she didn't want to sing it. So I had one song short for the album, and she still lived in Glasgow. She used to have to come down and she used to do the program. She was very good because we could do the record in record time with her. She was very quick. I said, "You'll have to come back the following week." And she said, "Oh, no, I'm not coming back from Glasgow." Well, I said, "I've got an orchestration of that song," because I knew her range and everything. I said, "If you did that, you wouldn't have to come back." So she grudgingly did it. And, of course, once I got it on the album, then I put it out as a single.
One day at a time, sweet Jesus. Ooh, one day at a time, sweet Jesus. Show me
when you walk among men. Well, Jesus, you know, if you're looking below, it's worse now than then. Cheating and stealing, violence and crime. So for my sake, teach me to take one day at a time.
George produced 8 hit albums for Lena Martell, but his eye for talent was becoming more and more recognized. In 1974, a new talent show was about to hit the television screens, with acts being judged by a panel of showbiz experts.
Yes, it's New Faces. And here he is, Derek Hobson.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Welcome. Well, this Easter Sunday I'm clutching 2 of these little buskers. Let's welcome panels. Well, you've recognized these faces by now, of course, starting with Mr. George Elric. Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen. Mr. Terence Wogan.
A great comedian once said, comedy is like doing the splits over a lobster. It depends how it grabs you. I hope I've nipped you a little bit in the right place tonight. Thank you very much indeed.
There we are, Joe Jones. He didn't win the last time, George Elric. Did he win with you today?
Yes, he did win with me today. I thought he was very funny. I liked his sense of timing. And there's a lot of novel gags there as well. I hadn't heard many of them before, but as they say, it's the way he tells them. His timing was absolutely perfect. I thought he was a very good comedian indeed.
Well, that's what George thought, ladies and gentlemen, of Joe Jones. Yeah.
On a show where some of the panelists were less than kind to the budding stars, George was always constructive with his criticism and picked Lenny Henry, Jim Davidson, Victoria Wood and Marty Kane as potential big-time contenders. He's a member of the Water Rats, and in fact he was appointed King Rat on 2 occasions and as a founder member of the Variety Club. Through his work with these organizations, George Elric has helped raise thousands of pounds for many charities. International Chief Barker of the Variety Club, John Radcliffe, was impressed by one Elric project in particular.
It was a record called Hail Variety in about 1983, if I recall. He made it together with Maurice Levy. And it featured songs by about, I think, something like 40 different stars. There was Vera Lynn and Mantovani and Tommy Steele. And the record was sold to Friends of Variety to raise money for the work of Variety looking after disabled and disadvantaged children.
12 noon, manicure big toe with anchor. 1:05, cast off from boy and tie up to girl.
Can I do your nails, sir?
Tommy Handley entertaining the fleet with, of course, Mrs. Mop. The ever-growing radio audience waited every Saturday, the traditional festival night of the music hall, to hear Elsie and Doris Waters, the Weston Brothers, Clapham and Dwyer, George Formby, and comedian Arthur Askey, who now insists on singing.
Well, there you are, playmates. It's inevitable. I can't help it. And here it is, the beat.
What a glorious thing to be, a healthy grown-up, busy, busy bee, whiling away the passing hours, pinching all the pollen from the cauliflowers. I'd like to be a busy, busy bee, being just as busy as a bee can be, flying round the garden, the sweetest ever seen, taking back the honey to the dear old queen. Honeybee, honeybee.
Another project he instigated was the All My Own Work exhibitions. These 2 shows raised thousands of pounds for charity and featured paintings and tapestries by fellow entertainers like Dame Judi Dench, Tony Bennett, Michael Bentine, Val Dunican, Noel Coward, and his great chum, Dame Vera Lynn.
He knows I paint a little bit, and he had, I think, 2 years running an exhibition at Earl's Court for one of the charities, and he got me to exhibit one or two of my paintings, some for show and some to sell, because he used to paint himself a little bit in the past, but he's too busy now on his career to paint. But he used to be very keen at one time.
George Elric lives and breathes show business, and Bert Whedon is one person who doesn't need convincing of this.
George, I heard, had to have a very serious operation on his heart, having a valve replaced, and I knew the day that he was having the operation, so the next day I phoned the hospital to check up how he was, and at that time George was in his late 80s, and it's a very serious operation for a man of that age, and I phoned up and I said, could you tell me how Mr. Elric is? And they said, oh, he's getting on fine. So I said, thank you very much, would you give him my regards? So they said, well, would you like to speak to him? And I said, well, is it possible? So they said, yes, yes, as a matter of fact, it is. He's made a remarkable recovery. And they put me through, and George's voice came through on the telephone. Hello, Bert. I said, hello, George. I said, you've had your operation. He said, yes, I'm sitting up in bed having a cup of tea. Now, I want to tell you about my new LP that I'm going to do and a new book that I'm writing. And this was like 24 hours after a major, major operation on a man of 80s. So he's an incredible man for energy and ideas and drive.
In 1994, John Ratcliffe of the Variety Club organised a convention which George Elric wouldn't have missed for the world.
I was very instrumental in encouraging George to come to Israel. We have an international convention each year, and we have people coming from places like Australia and New Zealand and all around the world, Canada and America, to our international convention. And George celebrated his 90th birthday just over a year ago. And I have to say, he was the life and soul of the party. When the convention ended, we did a post-convention trip. And we went out to some of the famous sites there. And there was one particular site we went to. And it was really a number of cities built on other cities over many, many centuries. And when we were dropped off, they advised anybody that wasn't fit or anybody that was a little bit overweight or a little bit elderly to stay at the bottom while the others went to the top. And if they would just wait 45 minutes, we would return. Quite a few of us puffed our way to the top. And when we got there, guess who we found up there? First man to the top was George Elric, aged 90, fit as a fiddle.
So, has George Elric's enthusiasm for his career and the entertainment business waned through the years now he's in his 90s? Not according to his former sax player and friend, Harry Lewis.
He was always talking music, he was always talking career-wise, he was always going to be the great artist, and he's still going to make it, you know. I mean, he has made it in the past, but he's going to make it once again. By the time he gets the Queen's Telegram, he'll be famous again.
You take the rough with the smooth. Can't all be magic. But most of it was. La da 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 dee 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 da 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 dee 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 da 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 dee. I'll be with you all again tomorrow morning. La da dee 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 da.